Hey guys, if you know me, you know I love to travel and you know I love to save money. This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. From choosing the right travel card to dodging hidden fees, Smart Travel helps your money go further. Literally. They cover all things travel finance, like how to plan group trips that don't bust your budget or your friendships. How to maximize points for real savings, not just free bottled water. How to avoid paying for upgrades you won't use, and so much more. They're doing great work over there. Check it out. Travel smarter and spend less with help from NerdWallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
Welcome to the Travel Tales Podcast. The winners are the people with the most stories.
One of the great things about traveling is the people that you meet.
I've slept in bus stations, I've slept on people's floors.
And it's already on fire, and then there's just a gigantic, huge explosion, like out of a Hollywood movie.
It's not right or wrong, it's just different.
We hired 10 Chinese prostitutes to come be our audience.
We were kidnapped by nuns in Puerto Rico.
Not a good idea to be high when you're packing. You forget a lot of stuff.
I got swine flu.
By the time you've lived through it, it's just a good story.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Travel Tales Podcast. My guest today is Kate Fincham. And before we get to Kate, here's a few announcements. Our website is traveltalespodcast.com. There you'll see some photos of me and some stories that I've written, some stories that some of the guests have written. You'll see photos of their guests. You'll see links to their social media, and you'll see links to our social media, which is, of course, the big one, Instagram. Travel Tales Podcast on Instagram. Follow us there. Get those numbers up. I'd appreciate that. We also have a Facebook page. You can follow us there as well. And while you're in a following mood, why don't you subscribe to us on whatever platform you listen to us on? Whether it's Apple Podcasts or Spotify or iHeartRadio, whatever you listen to your podcasts on, we're there. And if you can subscribe, follow, say a few nice things, that's a very cool thing for you to do. Let's get those numbers up there as well. Tell your friends, tell your family, and listen to the Travel Tales Podcast. If you think you might be right for the show, or you know somebody who might be right for the show, or you want to ask me some travel questions, or maybe even tell me I'm cool, you can write me at traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. That's traveltalespodcast@gmail.com. Kate Fincham is someone I found online. I saw her Instagram page just because the algorithm suggested it. And that doesn't always work out, but in this case, the robots were right. Her Instagram page is called My Little Houseboat, and it's exactly what you think it is. It's a woman, Kate, living on her own little houseboat. She lives in Toronto, and yes, she's there all year round, through the beautiful summers and the cold winters, on a houseboat. So her page is all about the experiences of living on this houseboat, buying it, what it's like, maintaining it. And I gotta be honest, I've always been kind of interested in houseboats. I see them and I go, man, I don't know if I could live on one. Or maybe I could. Maybe I'd love it. Maybe I'd hate it. I have no idea. I guess until I do it, I'll never find out. But as someone who works a lot of the year on cruise ships and spends a lot of time on the water, I kind of look forward to staying on dry land when I get off of work. But that's just me. But her boat looks pretty cool, and I reached out to her, and lucky for both you and me, she was cool as well. She was happy to talk about her life on the boat, and also her previous life of working on boats. Once she got out of university, she worked on some yachts, private yachts, all around the world, which is another gig that I find interesting. So she was interesting, she was very nice, and I'm happy she agreed to be on the podcast. Please enjoy my chat with the star of My Little Houseboat, Kate Fincham. Kate Fincham, welcome to the show. I'm glad you're doing this, and I'm glad you have a name because the whole time I was corresponding with you, I was calling you My Little Houseboat, and I figured you must have an actual name. So welcome, yeah. Kate.
Thank you.
Fincham. I found your site on Instagram, your page on Instagram, and started following you. I think it was recommended to me by, it must have been on the algorithm for Instagram or something. How long have you been living on this houseboat, and when did you decide to go viral with it?
So I moved on in COVID. This was one of these crazy COVID decisions. So November 2020, I moved on the houseboat. I bought in August. And it was one of those things that you just don't really expect in your life, and it just comes out of nowhere. I have a long history with boats and being on the water, and I worked on yachts for years and sailed around the world on a tall ship. And so water and boats has always been a part of my life, and it's been really important to me. And when I moved to Toronto, you know, we're a very much a waterside city, but we're not, you know, it's not very accessible to be right down by the water. And I saw an article about houseboats for sale in COVID, and I thought, perfect, that's exactly what I want to do. And I decided to take the leap. I knew no one who lived here. I knew nothing about houseboats and just did it. And I'm so glad I did.
Well, I'm from Chicago originally, and I've been to Toronto. I actually took my first trip to Toronto, believe it or not, only 2 years ago. It was the last major city in Canada I hadn't been to. I mean, I've been to the Maritimes. I've been to PEI, for God's sake. Hadn't been to the biggest city. And it was great, and it reminded me actually a lot of Chicago.
But I hear a lot.
Yeah, it's and I lived in New York, too. It's kind of a combination of the both. But I do know that having grown up that way, that a houseboat in August seems like a good idea until February rolls around. So did winter hit you hard? I mean, how was that first winter?
It was interesting, I'll tell you.
Since I
moved in November, so it was already kind of time to get the houseboat all ready for the winter time. And I have bubblers that I put in to keep the ice from freezing around the houseboat so it doesn't crush the pontoons. And then heat tracers on my pipes and my water intake. And the first winter, I didn't quite have it right. So it's taken me years, but I had my pipes freeze a few times, my toilet froze. I, you know, had a few run-ins, but I'm very lucky that I have a neighborhood that all the floating home residents, you know, they all came over with their, you know, different devices to help me chop away at the ice and, you know, try and unfreeze the drains and everything. So it was, you know, a really nice lesson in community. And I think over the years, I've kind of honed my winter time.
Yeah. Explain bubbler to me. How does that work?
So they're like little underwater fans, and they, you know, you put them on timers, so they go on and off, and they just agitate the water so it doesn't have an opportunity to freeze over.
Okay, so now you're on this. How far away from downtown Toronto would you say your dock is?
So I'm about, I usually take the train in, and it's an 18-minute train ride downtown, or maybe 30-minute drive.
Okay, so that's not very far at all. How big of a dock are we talking? How many other houseboats are there?
There's about 25 floating homes, which are a bit larger, and they're on floating concrete bases, and then maybe another 20 houseboats. And then there's also the rest of the marina, which are kind of full-time boaters and then seasonal boaters.
Okay. What was it about boat life and houseboat life that won you over as opposed to just buying a condo? Were you living? Did you own your place before, or how did this all happen?
So Toronto is one of the least affordable cities in North America, unfortunately.
Yeah, I live in LA, so I mean, I
can, you would know.
Yeah, I'm looking at a raft myself. So
definitely. So I thought, you know, I'm never going to own a place myself of my own. It's always going to be, you know, renting or living with housemates or that sort of thing. So it was incredible to find this place. And the difference in my life from downtown, which was wonderful, and, you know, there's tons of restaurants and it's very exciting, to living here is absolutely astronomical. You know, I wake up this morning, I woke up very early, I packed a picnic, got in my kayak and went to the beach and, you know, watched the sun rise and ate my breakfast and then paddled back home and started my work day. But, you know, being able to do things like that and just, you know, live on the water, it's so peaceful down in the park here. It's a really different pace of life.
I was just in Victoria, Canada, when I was working on a ship, and we stopped there, and you can walk to Fisherman's Wharf there, and there's all the houseboats there. I think I sent you a photo.
Yes, you
from
did.
There. Yeah. So it seems like a cool idea, except for that place, it's just a million tourists a day all summer walking past your house, which is I would not want. Is living on a houseboat, is it the same problem with a regular boat in that everybody I've talked to who's ever bought a boat says the same thing. It's a hell of a lot more maintenance than you think it will be. Is it the same for a houseboat?
So being someone who worked and lived on boats before, it's the opposite. You know, I was expecting there to be a tremendous amount of work and upkeep. And in reality, it's really not. I take it out of the water about every 2 to 3 years and just redo the pontoons, sand them down, you know, repaint them. And then it's just kind of here and there, normal things that you'd have on a house, you know, fixing, I don't know, whatever it may be, but it really leans, I would say, more towards a home than in kind of a small condo than it does towards a boat.
How about, I don't know, not to get into the actual particulars of everything and actual numbers, but does it work like you buy the houseboat itself and you own that, but then you basically pay rent on the slip, like the dock
exactly.
fees?
Marina.
Okay. Like HOA fees, kind of.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Now, are all these boats, I don't know, how old is your houseboat?
It
was birthed 10 years ago.
It came out of nowhere in 97.
Oh, okay. So how many previous owners?
It was before me, every 2 years, it kind of seemed to be sold off. And then the first owners who built it, they were artists and they were here for probably about 10 years, I would say.
Okay. Now in terms of square footage, what are we talking here? Bedrooms, baths, give me the whole realtor lowdown.
It's very open concept. So the only door that actually closes in my place is the bathroom. And then it's about 625 square feet with the decks. So there's a little front deck. There's a waterside deck on the other side. And then I have a little kind of top deck as well, where I have outdoor furniture on there.
Well, forgive my ignorance in this in terms of it's a house. If you had to move and go down the river, I don't know. Will it go? I mean, do you have engines to do that? Can you? I don't think you could take it out in open sea, but I mean, does it move?
It doesn't have an engine. So when I need to get it taken out for work and that sort of thing, we have a tugboat in the marina that will just tug it to the slip.
You're not out there with paddles? You're not there with oars? And okay.
It's not very seafaring, this, I don't
right.
think.
Does that? So is it like an inlet or is it a river or is it a bay? You get any kind of wave action or is it pretty calm all the time?
We're on Lake Ontario here, but we're within a kind of little inlet. The marina is very well protected. So it's very rare that, you know, I'm moving a lot or tipping over. It's just if the winds blow from the east that it kind of really becomes a bit problematic. But other than that, it's very calm and easy.
Do you have a daily commute into the city or are you freelance? I don't even know what you do for a living. Is this Instagram your whole deal now?
Unfortunately, in Canada, we don't make money off of Instagram content creators do in the States. So they get paid and we don't, which is most unfortunate. So I do have a real full-time job.
Wow.
I know. It's very unfortunate.
I did not know that.
I do it for fun. Yeah.
Wait, so you can't have like a YouTube channel or anything like that that makes money?
I could. And I think YouTube might be the only one that you can make money in Canada from, but that feels like more of a commitment. So I haven't branched out into that yet, but keep your eyes peeled for it.
What is your full-time job? Or you don't have to say, but you can be vague about it if you want.
I work in marketing for a corporate interiors company. So I've been there almost 10 years now, which is amazing. And I'm very lucky that I can work remotely if I want. I can, you know, go into the office, which is right downtown Toronto, if I want to. And I can also work from, you know, my parents live in Antigua in the wintertime. So I often go there for a week or two and work from there. So I'm very agile, which is great.
Oh, wow. That sounds great. When you said earlier, you referenced your life working on boats. Give me this history. And did you grow up in Ontario and you were just a boating family? Or when did this all happen?
Absolutely. We'll start at the beginning. I grew up sailing when I was a kid. That was kind of my summer camp, was doing sailing. And I always loved it. And then when I was in university, when I graduated, I wasn't really sure kind of what avenue I wanted to go into, or, you know, I hadn't figured that out. And so I heard about the fact that you can work on sailing yachts. And I had also in high school, I'd spent nearly a year on a tall ship sailing around the world. And that was really, such a transformative experience for me at that age, especially in getting to travel and learning, you know, the sail training and sailing the boat and living on board was just absolutely incredible. So I wanted to go back to something similar to that. And then started working on sailing yachts for a few years after university.
Wow. So wait a minute. In high school, it was a year on this boat?
It was 10 months. So we did classes and also, you know, sailed the ship and got up for 2 hours for night watch every day and did 2 hours of day watch every day. And so we were the crew.
How big of a crew?
There was 48 of us who were students and then 66 people altogether with the professional crew and some teachers.
What an incredible experience. I mean, this isn't like, I've heard a semester at sea and I've talked to people who are involved in that, but this seems like a whole different thing. This is like for people who want to work on ships. I mean, so where did you start and where did the boat go for 10 months? I mean, where did you end up?
We started in Vancouver and then sailed over through the Pacific to Hawaii, and then over to Australia to Africa and then around the Cape of Good Hope there and then over to Brazil and then up the coast and ended up in Quebec City.
That's incredible. So
it was.
Wow. I mean, what was the scariest experience on that thing? The roughest seas or whatever it was? Did you meet pirates? I mean, what was the scariest thing?
We had a few pretty bad storms, and one of them I remember, it was about 3 a.m, pitch black. I was on watch, so kind of just sitting there, you watch out to see if there's any other boats, and usually there's one person helming. And I saw kind of a wall, what looked like a wall of rain coming towards us, and it had been absolutely flat calm, and we only sailed, so we didn't motor. It was an old school square rigger ship, like, you know, master and commander sort of thing. And so I saw this coming towards us. We had every sail up because we were just drifting with the no wind sort of thing. And this hit, and it was a line squall, and it went from, you know, 0 mph winds to, you know, 90 mph winds. And it just blew, you know, holes in 3 of the sails immediately, the force of the wind. And then there was kind of large ropes that it just ripped in half, the force of it. So we went completely over, you know, the one side was underwater, all the railings on the one side. And the captain came out and he said, you know, Josh, Kate, you have to go up the mast and go like furl in those sails because, you know, we're going to lose some more. And so we had to climb up the mast, which was, you know, 120 feet. High. And at that point, you know, it was like climbing horizontally rather than vertically and the wind just pushing us. So we climbed up these, you know, little rope ladders that you get to the kind of cross trees of the mast and trying to pull in these sails and everything's just whipping around and it was howling gale and absolutely pouring wind, just driving rain. So we, you know, Josh and I kind of were able to gasket up the sails and tie them up and try and get everything in order. And they had an alarm went out to all the crew. So everyone was on deck eventually and came to help. But it was a wild experience. I remember thinking, you know, sitting in the mess hall afterwards and being absolutely drenched and just shaking because at the time, you know, your adrenaline kicks in and you just do it. And then you realize, you know, they tell you when you get on this boat, if you fall over in a storm, the likelihood of us being able to get you is almost zero. Like there's no visibility. There's, you know, with the waves, we can lose someone immediately. And so that was kind of in my head afterwards. And, you know, you're 16 years old, you wow. think you're invincible. And then something like that happens and you realize like, you are not invincible. You are this tiny speck in this giant ocean and you're insignificant.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a crazy story. And the fact that, you know, they let teenagers do this, I mean, that seems like highly dangerous and risky. And I guess you're in a country that doesn't sue people at the drop of a hat. Maybe that's that's probably an advantage or disadvantage, as if it were. But you don't have to say how long ago this was, but was there any internet on this ship? I mean, what was the situation?
No, this was 20 years ago at this point. We just had our reunion.
Oh, my gosh.
And so it was, yeah, we definitely did not have Wi-Fi. It was when we got into ports, you know, often you'd find an internet cafe or, you know, back in those days.
Ah, those are the days.
Sometimes I remember Cape Town had Wi-Fi in the harbor, which was mind-blowing. It was so cool, but nowhere else. Cape Town was way more advanced than
exactly.
everywhere else. Yeah.
Wow. I mean, what a – did everybody last through the whole thing, or did people drop out? I mean, did you have, like, some people quit and say, this is too much?
We had – I think it was two or three people leave, but it wasn't really because they couldn't hack it sort of thing. It was just unrelated reasons.
Okay. Wow. So this made you want to, well, not join the Navy, but you did get a love of ships.
Yes.
That's
and boats
incredible.
And water. Yeah.
So, and boats. So one more story and then we'll get off that old one. But, what was the most incredible experience you think you had? Was there one standout thing in your mind that just kind of blew you away?
There were so many. I mean, especially at that age to be, you know, released into, I don't know, wherever you were in Marshall Islands or whatever. And just they said, you know, be back by 11. And you got to explore these unbelievable countries and just meet these amazing people. And I think it was such a formative age to be able to do that and kind of have those sorts of adventures. But I would say the Marshall Islands, there was a number of things that just, it was so magical. We ended up meeting a family there who really took us in and showed us around, and they owned a dive store. And so we got to go dive these kind of World War II battleships and the most amazing biodiversity I've ever experienced in the coral and you know, going into some of the traditional villages there and learning about their culture. And the beaches were the most beautiful beaches I've ever seen in my life. It was just, it was like a fairy tale there, just everything about it.
Wow. That sounds really cool. So then you come back, you go to university, you get out. When did the working on ships again, were you working on those like super fancy yachts that rich people say, hey, pull my yacht around to Europe, and then you would sail it across the ocean to Europe? Or was that one of those deals?
Yes, it was one of those. We had a wonderful owner, but he was very busy. And, you know, it was a 155-foot sailing yacht, so nothing to snuff at for a private yacht.
Yeah.
And he would call up the captain sometimes and say, hey, can you be, you know, maybe in Palma in a week? And the captain would say, we're in, you know, Antigua. We can't be there in a week. And he'd go, okay. And then we wouldn't hear from him for 3 months, you know. so we were lucky that he loved being on board when he could be, but he was on board maybe 1 or 2 weeks a year maximum.
So I see these ships and I see the staff, and it's always these, you know, young people in their 20s, it always seems, on these things. What is your daily schedule like? Like you said, he'll call up and go, okay, we can't do it. I'll talk to you later. And then you just hang out in Antigua on this boat and do what?
So we, you know, it was a very structured work day. So you would work Monday to Friday. I was a stewardess, so it's a lot of organizing, cleaning. I mean, the level of how perfect these yachts are is quite incredible. It's like you're using a Q-tip to clean the baseboards, you know, once a week sort of thing. For you know, I was a second stew to begin with, and that was, you're taking care of the crew as well. It's one of those things. When I started, I thought, how on earth can we have 40 hours a week that we are working and keep this up with, no, you know, when you don't have people on board? And by the end of it, I was like, there's so much to do. You know, I think once you once you get into that mindset of having everything, you know, perfect and really trying to, when you do have guests on board, make their experience so memorable and special. And so you're kind of preparing for that as well. And it was, yeah, surprisingly a 40-hour a week job, unless you had people on board, in which case, you know, you were up at 4 or 5 and you went to bed at 1. So those were exhausting days.
Yeah, I bet. How big of a crew is that?
There was 8 of us.
8 of you. Now, I mean, that's tight. I mean, you got to get along. I mean, did you have some, I mean, I think one person could, one of the 8, if they're an asshole, could ruin this whole experience. So, I mean, what was the interview like process? I mean, I think it would be more about your personality and along with your, you know, work ethic. But I mean, you got to know if you can get along, right? I mean, what was the interview process like?
Honestly, I should have called you before my interview because I didn't really understand that, you know, they called me and they said, okay, fly down to Newport, Rhode Island, and we'll do an interview there. And if you get hired, we'll pay for your flight. And I just graduated university. I spent my last amount of money basically for the flight down to Newport. I get there, I have to stay in this terrible little hotel that's like 20 minutes outside. You know, it's absolutely just depressing. But I get to the hotel and I'm waiting and they said, okay, we'll come pick you up for, you know, to kind of meet with the crew. So they pick me up. I go to the boat. We're sitting around the crew mess table. We're just chatting a little bit. They ask me a few questions, but not really much. You know, it's just the whole crew there having coffee. And they say, okay, great. We'll take you back to your hotel. And I was like, but you didn't really ask me any formal questions. I had all these answers prepared. You didn't ask me about my experience, you know, in any of these things. And so I get back and there's a little, you know, McDonald's next door. I go get the depressing salad or something. I'm sitting on the bed thinking, what do I do? I don't have enough money to fly back home. I was kind of, all my eggs were in this basket. And anyway, the stewardess called me up, the chief stew, and she said, hey, we're all going out to dinner. Do you want to join us? And I said, I've just eaten, but I'd love to join you for a drink and I'd love to come. You know, I'll just have a drink. And thank goodness I did, because we went to this very fancy restaurant in Newport. I think it was probably like $150 a person, and had this wonderful—
Let them take you to dinner.
Yeah.
Don't sit there with your sad McDonald's salad and go, no, I just ate. You're just like, no, yeah, I'm hungry.
Good. It was mostly done. It was, yeah.
Good.
Impressively done. But anyway, so we had this nice dinner and drinks, and then they said, oh, let's go for a drink after. So I withdrew my last $60 I had to my name and bought drinks for the crew. And I remember waking up the next morning thinking, I hope it worked. I hope they like me. Like, it, you know, it's such a personality fit at that point. And sure enough, she called me about an hour later and said, okay, great. Do you want to move on the boat now? Wonderful.
So wow.
I just brought all my stuff and that was the start of it.
That's the best round of drinks you ever bought.
It was. Great investment. Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't teach you that in college.
Exactly. That's what they need. Yeah.
Yeah. So how long did you work on this ship? Was that the only one you did, or did you move from yacht to yacht?
That was the only yacht I worked on. I did it for almost 3 years, so it was an amazing experience. My crew were incredible. I was really lucky that it was a very adventurous, outdoorsy crew, so they loved going hiking and doing activities wherever we were. So I had a really good crew. And then, you know, when I left, it was just, I realized that there's no real career in yachting. So it was wonderful while it lasted. I absolutely loved it. But it's very hard, especially as a female, to kind of have a career in that. So I thought, all right, it's time to move on to the next adventure.
Yeah, it's a pretty transient life, too. I mean, you're all over the place and it's exciting. It's like, I knew guys who became ski bums after college, yeah. You know, and then just, but then they start turning 30 and going, I don't know how long I could keep this up. You know, it was great in my 20s, but it's just like, if I'm going to want more, you got to kind of like, all right, back to reality. Because there was just no real way to move up. And I don't know was the money decent? Could you save something or was it all just kind of gone? Were you
it
paid
was
an
great.
Experience?
You know what? Okay. Especially coming from working in a coffee shop during university, it's a lot of, you know, everything's paid for when you're on the boat. You don't pay rent. You don't pay for food. You have a chef who cooks all your meals for you. So it's pretty great because, you know, everything that you save, you goes into your bank account. Like you're not paying money for anything.
How about do the rich guests, do they tip you? They give you a little something under the table?
That saved me in the beginning as well because we went right into a charter. We had a week charter. And then at the end of that, we got, you know, a $2,000 cash tip. And so it kept me until my next payday. It was
absolutely
very exciting. But unfortunately, we weren't a big charter boat. Well, fortunately and unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, you know, we only did maybe one or two a year.
What were some of the highlights? Were there some days you were just on this yacht going, I cannot believe we're actually here and being paid to be here. This is so awesome.
I mean, most days it was wonderful. It's imagine, you know, the stressful parts about traveling, I find, are kind of packing all your stuff up, making sure you have your passport, moving to a new location, figuring out how you're going to get there, you know, the whole transportation aspect. But you have everything with you. So you have your, you're like a turtle. You have your whole life there. And then you just walk off and you're in a totally different place than you were, you know, a week or two ago. And at nighttime, you know, you get to explore this island or wherever you are, this town. And then you just come home and you have all your stuff in your bed and no need to pack or unpack. So it's wonderful in that way.
Yeah. How about like the toughest experience? Was there one that just made you going, oh, man, we can't get out of this port fast enough or get off of this ocean fast enough? Like I've done the Drake Passage and stuff in Antarctica. And then that was like 5 days of nothing but hell of waves and things. I mean, did you ever get into some really rough areas?
You know, we were lucky on the yacht that I had two captains that they were really careful. So they always made sure that they really watched the weather window. So whenever we'd go down to the Caribbean from, you know, Newport or whenever we were taking a voyage, they would always watch and make sure it was a good time to leave. So I was never really encountered bad seas, but I was just in French Polynesia a month ago or 2 months ago at this point with a friend of mine has a boat and he was sailing there. And I got on board and there was massive swells where we were anchored and I was immediately sick. And I thought, no. How can this be? I lived on boats for years of my life. I literally live on a houseboat and it just did me in. It was so funny. It took me about 20 hours to get my sea legs because I was just
isn't that crazy?
Not having any of it.
I'm on ships all the time. Like I, you know, work on these cruises and you have to take the, you know, tender boats and everything. And I grew up being seasick, but then I've gotten used to it. I've never gotten sick on a cruise ship, even though I've had some pretty rough nights. But I was just in Hawaii and did the Kaanapali Coast, you know, the day trip where you go around in Kauai, you know, and you just kind of go. And man, I was nauseous. I haven't been that sick in a while. And so I just like, I can handle this. And then you want lunch? And you go, I don't think I do. I'm going to sit here and get my bearings because it was rough, man. And you never know when it's going to hit you. You just don't.
No.
Man, where in Polynesia? Were you in Tahiti?
I flew into Tahiti. So it ended up being one of these last minute things that I was supposed to be with my friend in the Marquesas Islands for 3 weeks or 3.5 weeks. And he at the last minute had to go back to Hawaii because he had a problem with the boat. And so the day I was flying out, I had to plan a completely alternate itinerary for 3 weeks in French Polynesia. So I ended up kind of doing a bunch of the islands around Tahiti. And then I flew up to the Marquesas Islands and met him in Nukuhiva. And then we sailed to Hiva'ua from there. So it was very cool because they're so different from those society islands.
Yeah, okay, because I was in Morea years ago, which I loved, but it just made me want to see more, you know? I mean, and that's – is it Morea? Are they the society islands? Like,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Okay, yeah. So you got beyond that because everybody knows like Bora Bora and Morea and, you know, Tahiti. And so where did you go and how did we get there?
The Marquesas Islands they're about a 3.5 hour flight away. They're really far and they're completely different. It's a different language, a different culture. They're very rugged. They're very unpopulated. There's almost no one who lives there. So it's incredible. It's like Jurassic Park sort of vibes. Wow. And it's a really special place to visit because not very many people visit there because it is so remote. But absolutely beautiful, you know, some of the most stunning hiking and landscapes there.
Where were you staying when you go to Marquesas? If your friends with the boat is gone, what did you do?
So I got there. So I spent, you know, 2.5 weeks in the Society Islands just staying around. And then I got there hoping he would come. I didn't know how long it was going to take. So I just stayed and I ended up finding this little apartment in someone's house that was just up a hill. So I ended up staying there, which was wonderful. Beautiful view of the harbor. And then when he got there, I moved on board for a few days.
Man, this sounds like an amazing trip. Are you a snorkeler, a scuba diver? I mean, do you do all that stuff?
I am, yeah. I unfortunately the scuba diving is supposed to be amazing in Nuku Hiva, and I don't I got my dive card when I was 14 years old, 15. I was really young. I do not have it anymore. I have no idea where it is. And normally,
you're probably in the system.
I am because, you know, everywhere I dive, I say, just look it up. But unfortunately, the dive center there, they were like, oh, we don't have the PADI database. And I thought, can't you just email a friend? You know, there's surely someone has access to PADI.
Yeah. Honestly, I've been diving for 30 years and most of the dive places, they don't even care. They'll take your word for it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You know, they will.
I don't know.
Yeah. Just, oh, I don't have it on me. All right. You know, and once you're in the water, they realize, oh, she does know what she's doing. And then you don't care.
Well, I don't know about that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, if you get in there and freak out and you don't know how to, like, what does this do? And then they're like, okay, you're out.
I've got the basics down for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, maybe you want to locate that dive card again. Yes. Or take it. But that's how, did you do a lot of snorkeling at least?
Oh my goodness. Especially in the Marquesas is a bit harder because it's not, you know, huge reefs. It's more kind of rocks emerging out of the ocean sort of thing. But definitely in the other islands in, you know, Wahine and Bora Bora and Morea as well.
You did go to Bora Bora?
Yeah.
Alone?
You know what? I was
alone?
Exactly. Right? I know. The most romantic
most
place
romantic place ever. Yes. Like just you and a bunch of honeymooners sitting there. Hey, what are you doing? Ma'am, we're minding our own business. It's what we're doing.
Like, but you booked for two, right? You know, not just
right.
you.
Yeah. Did your husband leave you on the way over? Yeah. What happened?
You know what? It's funny. In Bora Bora, I only met two honeymoon couples. Otherwise, it was kind of, you know, families or just people traveling. But I ended up staying on one of the little motus, the Ring Islands surrounding Bora Bora. And it was one of the most beautiful places I've ever stayed. I have to say, you know, it's worth the hype there. Maybe you know, on the main island, but definitely the waters and the snorkeling and the sharks and the manta rays. I mean, it's incredible.
I know everybody says, you know, the classic photo of it is, you know, those overwater bungalows that everybody stays in. And then a friend of mine did that. But it's, you know, you're talking like $1,000-$2,000 a night. It's ridiculous. So, I mean, luckily, he's in a position where he can do that. But I was not. I was like, well, I'm not doing that. And then Morea, I tell people, Morea, you could do that as well. And it's less than Bora Bora and easier to get to. But it's still like
less? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It's still like $1,000 a night or something if you want to do this. And hey, if people want to do it. But the beach next to it in Morea, at least the Sofitel in Morea, is free. And it's the same beach. You can see the bungalows from the... So I was like, you can just drive over and enjoy the beach. You're just not sleeping over it. So I guess I have to do it once.
The Sofitel closed, didn't it? I thought that's
no.
In COVID.
Oh, no, one of the other ones did.
No, it was
and
one
I
of the
think
other
it's, ones. Yeah, it's still closed. There's like two left on the island, I think, at least two. There's one on the on one side of it, and then the Sofitel's still there. But
okay.
Yeah, but one of the big ones did close, and it's still shuttered. It's right around when the shark ray or the ray alley, you know, shark ray.
Oh,
kind of
yes,
like,
yeah.
It's one right next to that. That one's closed, which is a bummer, you know, and they keep talking. There's a lot of politics involved and some. Yeah, the locals are still talking about it. But so the night, the place you found there, I mean, was it like super expensive? I mean, is this doable for
It was the most expensive place I stayed. It was about 300 and something American, I would say, a night.
That's which not
wasn't
insane.
Definitely not insane. And it was a little kind of off-grid collection of little huts sort of things. So there's a main little lodge and then three little beachfront huts, and they were just perfect. You know,
that sounds great.
Had everything you'd need. You know, you just walk right out onto the beach there, the little porch on the front, owned by this wonderful French couple, and they had two kids, and it was just spectacular. Everything about it.
That sounds awesome. So your friend with the boat, so he finally shows up.
Yes.
What, do you guys get like half a week together and then you gotta get back?
Gosh, not even. I was supposed to fly out. He arrived the morning and I was supposed to fly out the next morning. And I did that classic travel mistake where you book through a third party website because it's $100 cheaper. And in the long run, it's a terrible idea. But anyway, I ended up forgoing that flight. And I had to buy another $700 flight because they're so expensive because it's so far away from Tahiti. And so I just, you know, it's one of those, like, I spent so much money to get here to begin with. I took a month off work, whatever, you know, it is what it is. So then we had about 3 days that I was on the boat, and it was great to be able to sail to Hiva'ua, which was about a 36-hour sail. We had some really interesting, we battled these massive currents and had some really interesting weather, few squalls. So it was really fun. I'm so glad I did it.
This is a good friend to have with a boat. I mean, when he shows up, I mean, did you guys know each other from the old yacht days? Was this like a university friend?
Funnily enough, when we were kids, we sailed together, and he was actually my sailing instructor when I was a kid as well.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's great. That's great. So now you got to come back to cold Toronto. And so where were you? Were you have your regular day job when COVID hit, or were you still on the boats then?
Yes, no. I left boats, oh my gosh, many years ago at this point. So yeah, I've been working in this job about 9 years now. Okay. And so I was doing this job.
Is it the hardest thing as someone who likes to travel and see things? It's just, did getting a regular job kind of like freak you out for a little bit? You're like, ugh, I don't know. You get restless. I mean, were they good? I mean, you can work from home. Were you good with like maximizing your days off and your travel?
Oh yeah. People, I always talk to coworkers and they say, oh, I have vacation next week. And I say, oh, where are you going? And they're like, oh no, I'm just staying home. And to me, I'm like, what? Why would you waste your days off like that? What is the point? Mm-hmm. But you know what? It's funny, because I always said, you know, I'm not a 9-to-5er. Like, I will never be an office worker. And I actually love it. Like, there's something to be said about knowing your hours. You know, you can book your vacation months ahead if you want, or you can book it kind of close to the time. When I worked on yachts, you never really knew if you were going to get your vacation, just because if the boss came on board, you had to shut everything down. And I've worked a lot of jobs like that, where you're kind of at the behest of whoever's, you know, schedule it is. So I really love that, you know, what's going to happen, and you're able to book trips and everything. But it is, you know, I used my whole month of vacation, you know, in April and May, and now I cannot travel anywhere, you know, for vacation until the new year. And I have to say, it's killing me a little bit.
I bet. Well, I mean, if you can work from home, can you take little side trips around, I don't know, around Ontario? It's like, hey, you know what, we're going to go to Quebec City for a week, you know, or 3 days or something. You could work from there if you
definitely
really need to, right? Okay.
Yeah, I was in Montreal last weekend. It's very easy.
Okay, so you're not chained to a desk.
Adventures.
I mean, you could, right, okay. But yeah, no Bora Bora for you.
You know, yeah, exactly.
Anytime soon. So of all of those places you went, where did you really want to get to that you haven't been? I mean, do you have a bucket list for some stuff you haven't seen that you're dying to get to? Did this rich guy, the yacht, ever go to the Galapagos? Because that's been on my list forever.
Oh, I know. I would love to. No, unfortunately, they did 2 years after I left. So I left at a very poor time. Yeah. And they did the Panama Canal as well. I'd love to sail through the Panama Canal. I think that would
be
amazing.
That's good to do once. It's good to do once.
Yeah.
And then it's kind of boring.
I've heard it's not interesting, but... You know,
oh, it's very interesting. It's fascinating that it was done. And then you wonder if it could be done today. Well, by America, the Chinese built one next to it or something, or they're trying to build one, whatever it is. They built a second one now, but because the ships are so big now that, you know, they have to build a bigger, wider canal. But it is fascinating. But once you've done it and seen it, and it's an incredible history. But then now it's just a slow time going through locks and, you know, and then waiting. And then it's an all day affair, you know, but it's cool to see. Where else would you like to go?
There's so many places, honestly, at this point. But I'd love to do more of South America. I've kind of been a lot to the East Coast, and I was in Colombia as well 2 years ago, and I really loved it. So I would love to spend a bit more time in South America, I think, is up next when I get there.
How's your Spanish? How's your Spanish these days?
Más o menos.
You're right. How about French? You're supposed to know French, you know, in school.
My French is okay. I can understand a lot of French. I did this program where the Canadian government pays for you to go to the French, the part of, you know, Quebec that speaks French for 5 weeks. And then it's like adult summer camp. So that was very helpful. Yeah.
Okay. In terms of French, like in Polynesia, I mean, is it even close, or is their accent so crazy that were you getting by, or is it hard to understand, or is it like a hybrid language?
No, theirs is very true French, from what I understand of it, because there's also so many French people there, right? You know, in when I was in Raiatea, I feel like the entire island was people from France who had come over. So I think the Polynesians, their French is pretty true to France. But Quebecois French in Canada is different. But I feel like we've learned a kind of hybrid version where we have the France French, but also the Quebecois.
Yeah. They would probably get angrier at the Quebec people going there and be like, what? Like they do in France. And you're like, oh, what is that you're speaking?
Stop talking.
Horrible. Yes. Just speak English. Don't embarrass us anymore.
Yes.
Well, about the Caribbean, I mean, you're French. It's like when I went to, you know, you travel there a lot and then you get off in St. Bart's and you're like, ooh, and it's so very French and like.
So French.
Plane, direct flights from Paris and then, you know, there's running. They immediately leave the airport and start smoking on the sidewalk.
Oh, gosh. You know, yeah.
After that long flight, did your big yacht ever go down to St. Bart's? That was a really cool.
We used to do almost every year the St. Bart's Bucket Race, which is this kind of massive super yacht race. So it's so cool because it's only so yachts that are over 100 feet long that they can do this race. And they kind of have a few different categories. But it's incredible because it's not boats racing. It's boats that are the same. They're all custom built, right? So it's a pretty neat race. We used to fly in like 20, 30 race crew to kind of join us for that race. And then it's like a, you know, a few day affair. And you have, part of my job was to book all the restaurants for all the race crew and us and all the different places we were going to go. And it was so fun. That was actually probably one of my favorite parts about that job is the St. Bart's Bucket was just the best time, you know,
that
the parties
fun.
And the events and the dinners and it was amazing.
Boy, the 1% really leads this kind of life that none of us really know anything about. It's like, oh, you got to go to this one polo match that everybody, oh, I'm sure you do. I'm sure it sounds fabulous. Well, I've been to Newport, Rhode Island, I think once. My cousin got married there, so we were there for
wonderful.
Like a weekend. It was really great. But did you get to know that area pretty well? I mean, that was a whole different world over there, too.
Oh, it definitely is. It's, you know, Newport, that was kind of our home base for the summers. And the people there were wonderful. You know, we used to kind of be there until the shoulder season. So typically, you know, into the fall, maybe till October before we'd head down to the Caribbean. And just such a special place. Like, you know, it's such an interesting history and an amazing area. But, you know, we had something happen on the boat and just the community in Newport, Rhode Island was incredible. They're just really special people, really kind, supportive. And you don't kind of realize that when the tourists are there and then when they're gone, you realize what an amazing place it is. And I mean, it's amazing if you're a tourist as well.
Did you go up and down the East Coast? Like, because I did... For one summer, I did the Boston to Montreal
cruise.
It was 7 days up and then 7 days back. And we would stop in like Bar Harbor, Maine, Halifax. We stopped in PEI and then Quebec City. And then, we would go to Montreal. Did you ever take the ship up through that? Is that the St. Lawrence?
Yeah, we didn't. Yeah. We didn't do the St. Lawrence. We went to Bar Harbor one time when there was a hurricane that was coming through. So just from Newport, but pretty much Newport was around where we would stay, and then we'd go usually down to Florida or Savannah, Georgia, to get some work done in the fall, and then head on down to the Caribbean.
Wow! If you had to ballpark it, what would you say like the cost of owning? I don't even want to know the price of the yacht. But like the upkeep and paying the staff and just owning the boat year after year, what's the maintenance costs? I mean, what do you think his budget is?
$2 million a year.
How much?
to about 2 to 3 million when you factor in kind of the yard periods you have to do every few years and the maintenance and everything.
It's 2 million a year. Wow. Yeah. Do you get like benefits? Do you get any kind of like a health care or anything like that?
We had benefits. They weren't great, but you know, we had them. You know, if there was a major injury or something, we would have been covered.
Right. And you're in your 20s. I mean, what's going to go wrong, really?
Yeah, exactly.
So let's get back to your houseboat now. You started this Instagram about, did you start it right when you bought it or after you've been on it for a little while?
I started the Instagram because when I went to go buy the houseboat, I really didn't have any resources for it. And I couldn't find any information about people who lived on houseboats throughout Canada. So I thought it would be really neat to share it, you know, with my friends and then with the wider community. For anyone who's interested in learning about this kind of very alternative lifestyle, I would say. And it's been really neat to see it grow. You know, I have followers from all over the world. The majority of them are from the US, Canada, the States, Australia. But it's, you know, people will say, oh, hi from Germany or hi from wherever in the world. And it's really cool to have this kind of collective community of people with a shared interest in kind of nature and adventure and living on the water. And it's been really wonderful seeing that grow.
What would you do differently if you had to start all over again? You bought your houseboat. What's the first thing you would do differently?
Honestly, not much. I would, you know, the only thing I would do differently is not worry about it. I think when I first moved on board, it really, I thought, is this the craziest decision I have ever made in my life? You know, is it going to sink in, you know, 10 days or, you know, what's it going to be like? But I think you kind of just have to enjoy the journey of the whole thing. And is it a great investment? No, probably not. But from a quality of life standpoint, I mean, it's just been incredible. I don't think I could make a better investment in myself and my life than this. But from a financial standpoint, maybe not so much.
Yeah. Did you have a good support team? Do you have like friends and family who are like good with their hands that could help you with construction and stuff like that? Are you good with that?
I'm fairly handy. I grew up with a dad who, you know, taught us everything. And he was someone who learned how to do wiring from a book sort of thing and very self-taught. And so, you know, my dad's very handy. My brother is incredibly helpful and handy as well. So it's wonderful that, you know, most of the projects I can do on my own. And then when I can't, I bring in my team of my dad and my brother, and my mom is also very handy as well.
Nice. Do the people in the on Instagram chime in and go, no, do it this way, decorate this way? I like what you did there. Okay. Oh, really? They do give advice?
There's always, you know, that person who's like, it's not a bubbler. It's you know, called whatever. And you're like, well, we call them bubblers. It's fine. You know, you don't need to criticize this. But I would say, above board, like largely everyone is so supportive. You know, they love seeing the renovations I do. They love seeing the transformations and the work that needs to go into living on a houseboat. And it's cool. I would say very largely supportive.
It's funny when you called it a bubbler. That's what they call water fountains in Wisconsin.
Really?
Yeah, a drinking fountain. Oh. They call it a bubbler. Wisconsin people are weird. Oh. I was born there. Okay. Trust me.
Kind of cute. I like it.
Yeah, right? They call it a bubbler. And that's the only time I heard, when you said bubbler, I was like, she installed a water fountain on her. I said, sure. Do Toronto people say that too? I thought it was only Wisconsin. So what's the future plan? I mean, is this a long-term thing? Are you going to keep, I mean, do you look 5-10 years down the road and going, do you see yourself still living on it or maybe moving on to a different houseboat, a different part of the country, a different country? Where do you see yourself?
It's funny because before I bought the houseboat, I always had plans. I have a British passport as well to live other places. And I never felt like I was kind of going to stay in one place for a very long time because historically I haven't. And when I bought the houseboat, I have no desire to move anywhere else. And I just can't imagine not living here. You know, I was out for a kayak with one of my neighbors who's also in his 30s. And we kind of kayaked to the beach for sunset. And he goes, where do we go from here? You know, we're quite young relatively, and this is our life. Like, what is better than this? It's, you know, what do we achieve after this? So I always think about that. You know, I don't know, because there's always new adventures to be had and everything. But I think in the near term, I really can't see myself leaving for any reason, if possible. Yeah,
that's great. Well, that sounds very romantic. You should tell that guy, hey, you should have seen Bora Bora. Where were you when I was in Bora Bora by myself?
Yeah, exactly. Want to come on a trip?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's great. I mean, we say you have a British passport. Is one of your parents British?
My mom's British, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yes, because she's a mum and not your mom.
Yes. Oh, I didn't even think about that. It's funny. People always call me on that. They're like, that's not how we say things. And I never know it because my whole family says it that way. So,
of course. Well, I'm always fascinated going, like, in London, the canal boats.
Oh,
and it's the same kind of thing. Those people living on them, and I'm fascinated by those things. And they're a whole story in themselves. I could see you living on one of those, at least for a little while, for a summer.
Definitely.
That'd be fun.
I feel like my place is a little more comfortable than theirs, because I at least, mine's a bit wider.
Yeah. Those look tight. Those look tight, with a low ceiling.
They're called narrow boats for a reason, I think.
Yeah.
I follow a bunch of them on Instagram, and it's really cool to see their lifestyle, but theirs is a lot more moving. Someone told me that apparently you can't stay in the same spot for longer than, I think it's 3 weeks or something, and you have to move in one direction in London, in central London, just to make it fair that everyone doesn't, like, they don't get the prime spot and then stay there for 20 years. So you're always moving your boat, which I do think could make things a bit harder. You know, here I always know where my car is in relationship to my
it's very transient, though. They seem to be able to just pull up anywhere. I was like, really? They could just be here? And yeah, it's almost like an RV. You know, they just kind of pull your RV up. It's just like, oh, so they're homeless and they're just pulling up their home to wherever they want. It's like, it's kind of the same, but I'm sure there's some characters, man. I got to get to the bottom of that somehow. And you probably, yours sounds like a nice little community, you know, it's almost like a little suburb on the water.
It is. It's just the best community of people. Like, that was the one thing I didn't know moving here, what a tight community I'd be moving into. And, you know, we had a series of art classes for the last few weeks. We have games night once a week. You know, we have a paddle WhatsApp group. We have a games WhatsApp group. We have a community WhatsApp.
Oh,
you know,
nice.
There's always things going on. There's always people to spend time with, or, you know, you walk outside and people invite you over for drinks or for dinner on their, you know, rooftop. So there's always something.
Great. Well, now let's do the quick, the speed round here. Give me your, the craziest thing you ever ate abroad.
Oh, gosh. I'm not sure.
Are you an adventurous eater?
Answer. I feel like I eat a lot of things, but I probably all the street food I eat. I am very blessed to have a iron-proof stomach. So
good for you.
I have got sick exactly twice in my entire life from traveling, which is absolutely remarkable.
It is.
And I eat everything. I'm, you know, I obviously, if something looks sketchy, I'm not going to go for
sure.
it, but I'm a big fan of street food. So there, you know, if something looks delicious, I will eat it. Yeah.
How about any problems with the law or immigration at any border crossings or anything like that? Have you been pulled aside or interrogated or anything like that?
I have a funny story about that. It's actually the U.S.
I'm apologizing already.
When I was working on the yacht, since it was often based out of Newport, Rhode Island, it's flagged for the Marshall Islands. And so you're technically actually working for the Marshall Islands, but there's not really anything you can print off that says that. So I frequently had issues with, you know, coming in and out of the States. And often what I would do is drive through the Buffalo border and then fly out of Buffalo, because it was always cheaper and Buffalo was quite close to my parents' house. So anyway, this one time, I think it was one of the first times I'd done that. I got this border guard and he, you know, gave me the 400 questions and was like, you're not allowed to work in the States. And I said, no, but I can work in the States because I'm not technically working in the States. And I didn't want to lie about anything because I thought, you know, that's going to get me into more trouble if I just say I'm a tourist or whatever. And then I had to get pulled aside and it ended up being a several hour situation. Nearly missed my flight, but thank goodness I made it. And then maybe about a year and a half later, I was through the same border crossing. You know, the guy says, where are you going? Newport, Rhode Island. What are you doing there? Work on a yacht. And he goes, I remember you. He said, I just had some guys through the Navy the other day, and I was thinking about you. How's everything going? And it was the same border guard. Anyway, we had the loveliest chat, and it was so funny. But I thought, what are the odds of getting the same one twice, you know, when it was hellish to begin with? And, you know.
Did you have to get one of those special, like, right, like those, I've seen like, the guys on the ship, the cruise ships, got like, they have to get, like, maritime visas or seamen's visas. Did you have to get one of those?
No, we didn't. I didn't have one of those because, again, I guess we didn't need one for whatever the situation was. But, I mean, I had a maritime passport, which okay. was not super official. I think it's, you know, more of a logbook than anything. But
right.
you have to have papers from the yacht, you know, signed saying with the insignia saying, like, this person works on this flagged yacht. So
got it.
It was always interesting.
Yeah, I bet. Okay, now get your plugs in. Where can people find you? Is the Instagram the main thing, or do you have a website as well? Or
no, the Instagram's the main one, so it's at My Little Houseboat, all one word. I do also have a TikTok, but I've kind of fallen off that because people were mean. So
oh, people suck, don't they? They're horrible.
I know. It's not as great, but Instagram is pretty much where you can find me. I also have now a Facebook if you don't use Instagram. You can find me at My Little Husband on Facebook as well.
Yeah, look at you with your little blue check on Instagram. I'm impressed.
Right?
That's pretty good. I mean, I don't know, but I don't know. What's the process now to get one? It changes all the time.
It does. I mean, at this point, after if you have a certain amount of followers, you can just get one.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's cool. So you're kind of like internet famous.
A little bit. I've had
That's
some
cool.
funny kind of run-ins that people have seen, you know, my videos on YouTube or something that are people that are completely unrelated to me. So,
oh my gosh,
well,
you're not getting any stalkers, are you? Because you know people
no,
can track
thankfully.
You down these days. Thank God.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Be very careful. I just want to say,
I am,
just be
yes.
careful.
I have security okay. cameras and everything. So yeah.
Yeah. Good. So if after being all these places and all the experiences you've had, how has travel changed you as a person and how you look at the world? And how's it changed you? What have you learned?
I think travel has always been a part of my life. I've been really lucky that my parents, it was very important for them and it's become very important for me. But I think I've grown so much as a person because of it. You know, even if it's just a week going somewhere and meeting different people and seeing different ways of life and, you know, having that adventure, I think it really, it's made me look for kind of more unconventional, even, you know, living on a houseboat, that sort of thing. I think it makes you see what's possible in life and that life isn't the linear direction that, you know, is kind of the American dream sort of idea. Mm-hmm. Like there's just so many possibilities out there and there's so many lives to be lived and there's so many options. So I think for me, you know, it opens up a complete different world every time I travel.
That's great. I love to hear a Canadian talking about the American dream. That's always always makes me laugh. But thank you so much for doing this. Everybody check out My Little Houseboat on Instagram and I'm going to follow along and hopefully I'll get to meet you soon in person.
Yeah.
That would be fun.
Come to Toronto.
We'll go in a kayak. Okay,
exactly.
Yeah, I will. We'll go in a kayak. That'll be great. Enjoy the rest of your summer.
You too.
That's Kate, everybody.
For spontaneous travelers, winging it is the perfect listen. James Hammond shares stories and tips from 75-plus countries. Find it at voyescape.com.